In the grass, waiting for her ship.
This is what waiting for your ship sounds like. And you forget to bring the windscreen for your microphone.
Allison is a radio producer, so why is she on the top of this hill? It goes back to a question about the global economy.
Yeah, so you know how everything's made in China, right? How does it get here?
How does it all get here? A couple years ago, Allison started to wonder. She read on Wikipedia that 90% of all goods shipped globally don't come by plane or truck. They come on a ship.
I was like, what? A ship?
Turns out there are thousands of ships out there at any moment, trucking across the ocean day and night. Bulk carriers hauling coal, tankers full of orange juice, railroad ships loaded with brand new cars.
These ships are like the glue that holds the global economy together.
Allison decided she had to get on some of these ships to experience life on board. So she hatched a crazy plan. She was going to sail around the world on cargo ships.
I went to the library and printed out a world map. Basically took a pencil and drew a line around the world like, this is the route I'm going to travel.
One thing led to another, and on July 11th, Allison took her map and flew to Canada to get on her first ship, the MV Isa. Allison, want to take it from here?
Sure. So, the first thing I learned about life on board, you can never rely on the schedule.
Voice message.
Hi, Allison. It's John Henderson at Lake Superior Shipping calling about the ISA. We don't know which terminal this vessel is going to yet.
The ship was ready, but the cargo wasn't. They were picking up a load of wheat, and floods in the Western Plains delayed the trains. So, ISA's captain dropped anchor in the bay a few miles offshore and proceeded to wait. So, I waited too. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Every day, I climbed to the top of a hill and sit looking at the ship in the distance, wondering when I could get on board. After a week, the trains came. I bummed a ride to the outskirts of town, to the grain terminals where the ship was loading. There it was, the ISA. The ship towered above me and stretched out 200 meters. That's like two football fields. I stood there on the dock and watched as they finished tying up. Then, I climbed up the ladder. Steward greeted me at the top, showed me to my cabin, and gave me a quick tour of the ship. Three floors of cabins, kitchen, crew mess, laundry room, the quote, gym, a tiny room with a ping pong table and a bench press.
Captain! Ah, where's Captain?
The ship itself was big, but the living quarters were not. It's like they took an old college dorm and just plopped it down in the back of this huge ship. Not a new dorm, like one from the 70s. This ship was owned by a Polish company, and all 21 crew were Polish.
Reporter?
Yeah.
I told them I thought their job was important, that I wanted to tell the story of what their life was like. They shrugged and kept working. That's the sound of wheat pouring into the six huge cargo holds in the deck. Dust is flying everywhere.
How do you say dusty in Polish?
In Polish, it's kush.
Kush.
Yes.
Goggles. Oh my gosh.
Okay, so the second thing I learned about life on board...
Hello?
You don't bother the captain while he's at the dinner table.
Hello, Captain. When do you think we're leaving?
I'm eating now.
Okay, I'll leave you alone.
Oops. 2 days had passed since I came on board, and our trip was on hold again. The terminal had paused the cargo operation. Some of the cargo still wasn't here yet. I wasn't the only one tired of waiting. Mariusz Manko is the engine cadet. He's been on board for over 5 months, and at the end of this voyage, he's going back to Poland. So the longer we wait here, the longer Mariusz has to wait to go home.
It's just annoying doing every day the same things. Waking at 7 a.m., 7:30, breakfast.
First thing in the morning, he reports to the engine room. At 10 o'clock, 15 minutes coffee break.
12, dinner. First o'clock, work. Then the coffee, and work again.
Every day, Mario sits at the same place at the table. He joins the rest of the engine crew for dinner. Mariusz is only 21. It's his first time on board. He spent the last 4 years in school training for this job.
I'm the youngest in the crew, yeah? I don't have any histories on the sea.
On board, crew are always swapping stories about other ships.
Seeing the accidents.
Finding stowaways, dodging pirate attacks. The crazier, the better.
During my trip, I heard plenty of stories. And I were just listening. Yeah, uh-huh. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
few more days pass, a few more X's on the calendar, and we finish loading cargo, and we finally set out across Lake Superior, through the St. Lawrence Seaway, and out into the Atlantic.
The fact that we're moving is good news for Mariusz.
I'm gonna be leaving this ship.
You can say you've seen some of the world, I guess.
Yeah, a little bit. It's not much, but if I got the next ship, I could say my own sea story. Something like, you know, we on Isa had a journalist working on all the ship with a microphone and camera.
Roger, sir, copy that. You have exited International Earth. You may now return to channel 16 and have a good voyage, all.
So, Allison, you went around the world on cargo ships.
Yep.
So, you've been on all these ships. What's your sea story?
My sea story?
You know, the craziest thing you saw out there.
Okay, well, the crazy thing is just how cut off you are from the outside world when you're on a ship like that. That's what this story is about. It takes place on a tanker called Corsaro.
Corsaro?
Yeah, Corsaro. That's Italian for pirate. It was a special ship. For one thing, the crew was top-notch, especially the second officer.
Okay, I'm Shaula Binueza Ilaya, 24 years old. I'm a female. I'm a sea woman.
It's not easy to be the only chick on a ship full of dudes. Shaula was used to it. She gave me advice.
First impressions last. So, the first time you have to step on board, you should not swing your hips. You should walk like male. You should dress like male. Baggy pants, not fit.
I'd go up to the bridge every afternoon on Shaula's watch. We'd sit and talk. She'd always make tea. She told me how her name came from a star. Her father picked it. He's a sailor, too.
A second mate, the same as me.
She told me how she missed her dog back home in Philippines. It was December when I joined the ship. We spent Christmas together on the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are all here in this afternoon. For the first Corsaro Trophy.
On Christmas Eve, the whole crew staged a holiday ping pong tournament. Shaula was on my team.
We played captain and deck cadet. We almost beat them. Ugh, so close. I'm still not over it, if you can't tell. We spent Christmas Day in port, just like any other day, except we had roast pig for lunch. Shaula spent the afternoon in the cargo control room, monitoring pressure in the tanks.
How's it going?
Fine. Sleepy.
Merry Christmas back to work.
Yeah, Merry Christmas back to work.
New Year's Eve, we were in port again. Augusta, Italy.
Compa Mare Augusta, Compa Mare Augusta. Motor tanker Corsaro.
We were loading AAA jet fuel, the stuff they use to power airplanes. On New Year's Day, we set out for Turkey, hauling 18,000 tons of premium-priced fuel. And here's where the sea story really begins. We're sailing along, like normal. We're going to get orders from the office. Stop the engine. So we drift. A day passes. We set up fishing lines off the deck and try our luck while we wait. But after a couple of hours, word comes to start the engine again. So we set out. The next day, same thing happens. Again, stop the engine. So let me explain here. Oil prices change constantly. Today they're up, tomorrow they're down. In this business, if you want to make the big dollars, you wait till the last minute to make the deal, right?
When we left port, the deal for this cargo was still in limbo. They hadn't decided who was buying it. And now they keep changing their minds about where we're going. We don't really know what's going on. We just wait for instructions from the office. Another day passes. We finally get orders. We're heading to Aliaga, Turkey. Did you know the border of a country actually extends 12 miles out into the sea? The next day, exactly 12 miles off the coast of Turkey, we stopped the engine for a third time. We didn't have port clearance, so we couldn't enter territorial waters. The captain was on edge, pacing up and down on the bridge, keeping an eye on our position on the map. Night fell, still no news. But we were drifting dangerously close to a landmass, so captain gave orders to start the engine, steer slowly back and forth. I went to sleep as the ship paced up and down the coast, late into the night. The next morning, I woke up and saw Turkey out the window. We were at anchor, a mile offshore. Now, just one more step before we could berth and unload this cargo. We had to pass the cargo inspection. So a speedboat pulls up and a surveyor comes on board to take some samples. The next day, results come in. Cargo failed inspection. The jet fuel was contaminated with a teeny bit of biodiesel, so the buyer rejected the cargo. Now what?
1 day, 2 days, 3, 4, 5 days at anchor.
The vessel is 6 days already waiting, and nobody knows when we'll go alongside for discharging. Sure, there will be someone that have to pay for this delay.
While we sit here, emails bounce back and forth between Italy, Switzerland, Turkey. Captain Spilo explains.
I will show something.
He pulls out the bill of lading.
Consigni, Glencore Energy UK Limited.
That's a legal document between the parties involved in the deal.
Fighting. Today, they reach this other option.
Here on board, we're at the end of a long chain of transactions between the cargo buyer and the cargo seller. In between, there are brokers, agents, charterers, ship owner, and the banks.
Bank Limited London Branch. It's a complicated story.
It's day 10 of a voyage that should have taken 3 days. Time is money. Question is, whose time? Whose money? The delays add up to $150,000 so far.
But this is small amount of money. If you imagine the value of this cargo, 60, 70 cents per liter, multiplied 25 million, so that's why $150,000. It's a drop in the ocean. But anyway, it's our money. And anyway, nobody likes to pay.
While the businessmen shoot emails across time zones, arguing over money, we're stuck here.
When you start to think like this, you feel to be but very, very, very small. Very, very, very small. You can shout, nobody will listen.
Stuck at anchor and no telling when they're going to get out of there. What happens next? Find out when State of the Reunion returns.
This week on Prairie Performances, hear a broadcast of one of the many fine concerts and ensembles available to our community. Hear performances by Sinfonia da Camera, the Champaign Urbana Symphony, the Millikan Decatur Symphony, the Eastern Illinois Orchestra, the Prairie Ensemble, performances from the Allerton Music Barn Festival, and more. I'm Roger Cooper. Join me for Prairie Performances Friday evenings at 7 on WILL-FM.
WILL programs are made possible by Bavir Cafe. Bavir Cafe offers specialty coffee and breakfast, featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items, Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Bavir Cafe is staffed and managed by U of I hospitality students.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and today we are with the truckers of the high seas. That's right, we are hanging out with sailors who go around the world bringing us all the goods that we need and use every day. So, last time you heard us, we had left the crew of the Kasaro stuck at anchor about a mile offshore in Turkey. They've got 18,000 tons of jet fuel to unload, but the load is contaminated. And now the cargo buyer, cargo seller, and all the middlemen are arguing about what to do next. Allison Swaim has the story.
For the crew on board, being at anchor's no big deal.
We love it when we're at anchor. Why? We can relax.
There was only one problem. We were running out of food. We've been running low for a while. First thing to go was the fresh vegetables. That was weeks ago. For days, we had canned peaches with every meal. Then we ran out of peaches, so it's on to the pineapple. Then it was fruit medley, and that was the end of the fruit. One night, I'm eating dinner in the crew mess room when the cook comes in. Excuse me, Captain, sir. You can tell he's uncomfortable. He almost never speaks to the captain. And he says, sir, we only have meat left for 2 more days. The captain had already ordered provisions. The problem was, they were being delivered to the next port. Now, we're stuck here. 2 more days pass. In the galley, the atmosphere was tense. I walked in as the cook angrily clinked pot lids.
No, sir. What's left?
Pulls the foil off last night's leftovers.
This and French fries. That's it.
The crew had begun to notice supplies were running low. At first, we just joked about it. We argued about who we're going to have to eat first.
What will we do? We try to kill the younger one.
Arsa says the youngest one, but chief engineer disagrees.
No, I know we have to start for the oldest.
The problem with eating the oldest, Arsa says, is the meat's too tough. You'd have to cook it for 3 days.
The young man, no. He's ready to eat. He's ready to eat.
The more time that went by, the less funny it all seemed.
Really, this is a very, very, very strange voyage, because it never happened. Not in this ship, and not in other ship.
News came that an emergency food ration was coming from shore in a service boat, but a day passed, the boat never showed up. The next day was cold, dark, and windy. Any news?
For the gale warning.
Gale warning?
Bad weather.
Any news about the cargo? The analysis?
The question is, what's for lunch? The cook doesn't have any more to cook.
Food. Craving for food.
We have nothing left.
Benedict for days now. At this point, I've lost track of how long we've been here.
Okay.
We're never gonna leave here. I'm going crazy. I go to Shawa's cabin to get advice.
How are you?
You. There's like not enough space to move, and I'm like, I don't know.
It will pass when you're going to get used to it. Yeah. Also, my first time on board, I'll get crazy too.
What did you do?
Just let it pass and get myself busy with whatever. Like, don't feel like you're alone. You're, I don't know. For me, I enjoy sometimes alone. Maybe I'm just getting used to it.
I go out on deck to try to clear my head. I walk to the front of the ship, look down to the anchor shaft. Jomar's trying to catch some fish.
Catch anything?
Nothing. Just imaginary fish. You know, here? You always imagine there's a fish.
Imagine there's a fish. Imagine there are provisions. Imagine I'm in my country, he says.
Imagine all the imagination.
Then, Jomar gets some news.
Stand by.
Stand by. Basically means to get ready, just in case we move.
That's it. Stand by. Standing by.
Waiting.
Waiting for nothing.
At lunch, pickings are slim. White rice and french fries. On each table, there's a tiny jar of anchovies. Take a teeny piece of anchovy, spoon it over your rice. We're supposed to get provisions after lunch.
Maybe.
But 2 hours pass, still no sign of food. I go to the crew lounge and plop down on the sofa. Okay, in this room, there's always some stupid movie playing that nobody's really watching. And today, of all movies, somebody had to pick Cannibal. I go up to the bridge. Shawa's got her watch now. We sit with tea, keeping an eye towards shore, just hoping to see the boat coming with food. Imagine this. Just looking out of the ocean, hoping that speck's gonna turn into a boat. I see just a little boat. Let's see. Is this us? Maybe it's us. Look. You're coming to us. You think?
No, it's...
Nope. False alarm.
Nothing. I don't think so.
A few minutes later, she spots another small boat. She grabs the binoculars. It's hard to tell if the boat is coming towards us, so we place a bet.
I'll have hope. I bet it's us.
I'll bet the opposite.
The boat turns away. But then, wait.
You think they're coming to us? Look, they're coming to us.
It is food for us.
You see it?
Yes, thank God. Oh, fresh food. Cabbage, tangerines, carrots, potatoes.
Shawa radios to the crew. Everybody gathers on deck to take on provisions.
Okay, amigo, okay. Food. Craving for food. This is the consolation. We have food.
Yeah. Once the food came, everyone was in a better mood, including me. As for the cargo, the businessmen and their claims, still no news.
Well, we won't starve anyway.
I know, I really want one of those pears, like right now.
Yeah.
Wow. For a minute there, I was worried for you guys.
We would have survived. We could have made it okay on rice and pasta for a couple more weeks. I would have been grumpy, though.
So, what happened to the cargo?
It took them another week to sort it out. By then, we were running low on food again.
It just goes to show you how isolated you are on a ship like that.
That's the ironic thing. You can order something in a click on Amazon and have it delivered right to your door, but there's still somebody, a whole crew of guys and girls, who spend a month on the ocean to bring it to you. And when they're out of something, it's not like they can just go to the store.
Right, but they do get off sometimes, right? I mean, what's it like when they finally get to land after all that time at sea?
You want
to
find out? You're going to need a helmet, work boots, and a neon vest.
I got work boots. That's one out of three.
I've got you covered on the rest.
Seafarers make 5 million visits to the U.S. every year. So what happens when they hit U.S. soil? To find out, we took a trip to Port Everglades, Florida. We joined Ron Perkins, a port chaplain, on his daily ship visits.
Good morning. How are you today? We got two visitors that got temporary tags.
All right. No weapons.
No weapons.
I'm a good one.
Now, to the left up here, we're going to be passing what's called the pre-trade zone. These warehouses to the left behind the barbed wire-topped fences. That's not United States of America.
We're dodging trucks, passing huge silos of cement, miles of pipes and holding tanks.
And there are a lot of containers to our right.
There are thousands and thousands of containers.
We drive right under these huge cranes lifting containers off a ship and park right next to it.
Have you been, you've been cleared, haven't you? Yeah.
Yes. Follow Ron up the ladder on board. The officer on watch takes us inside and down a narrow hallway to the mess room where the crew is finishing up lunch.
Ah, how are you doing? Good to see you. I'm Chaplain Ron from Seafarer's House. Have you been to the Casa yet? We don't have free Wi-Fi. Just call and they'll send the van.
Okay. They don't have a lot of time to talk, though. As soon as they're finished eating, they bust their plates and disappear right back to work. They've been at sea for weeks. I mean, you'd think they'd jump off the ship as soon as they get to land.
Mm-mm. They're lucky if they even get a couple hours off the ship. Port's the busiest time. Everything happens at once. Coast Guard, customs, then there's a cargo operation. They gotta load and unload as fast as possible.
That sounds like a lot of pressure. So, we're on to the next ship. Right now, we are standing at the gangway to the Yacht Express. And, it is a hot day, and we are just waiting to see if we can come on aboard.
Yeah, the captain's not on board, so they won't let us board. And they've got visa issues. Not everybody's got U.S. visas. 3 Russian, 20 Ukrainians.
Yeah. Okay, Al, so here's another obstacle to getting out. These guys don't have U.S. visas.
Wait, so you're telling me even though they have time to get out, they can't?
No visa, no access. In most countries, seafarers have an exception in immigration law. Not here, though. Not since September 11th. If you don't have a visa, you can't even set foot on the gangway.
After we make the rounds, we head back to the seafarer's house.
I'll give you the grand tour. This is the Casa, which is where the seafarers come in directly off the ship.
There are hundreds of seafarer centers like this one in ports all over the world. This one was started by the Episcopal Church in the 80s. Even though the Casa has religious ties, it's not in your face. The only evidence is a small 10 by 15 foot room in the back left corner.
This is probably the most eclectic chapel you've ever been in.
Next to the cross, there's a Buddha with Chinese characters, Jewish prayer shawls, and a basket of Muslim prayer beads.
In the world, there are going to be people that don't think like you think. You want to make them feel welcome also.
The goal here is to make the seafarers feel at home. So the convenience store in the main room,
kind of a international 7-Eleven,
carries a pretty unusual selection of snacks.
I've never known there were so many different kinds of shrimp-flavored crackers, as an example.
Yeah, shrimp-flavored crackers. That's a top seller. They have 2 whole rows, all different varieties.
I've not been brave enough to try a pickled duck egg yet, but we've got those too.
Pickled duck egg?
It's midday, and right now it's slow. A few guys hang out, Skyping home on their laptops. On board, communication is limited.
Yeah, there's no internet, no cell service, just a satellite phone, and it's really expensive. So the first priority when sailors get to land is to connect to home.
First of all, what you usually do when you go on shore, you need to find an internet and to call it home. So your family will be informed that you're okay, your health status is good, you have enough food.
Nico and his shipmate, Alex, sit outside on the porch.
Ну так почему нет?
Alex holds his phone up to his ear.
He's speaking with his girlfriend.
Nico's typing text messages back home to the Ukraine. It's almost 10 o'clock there.
Everybody's sleeping, so only messages, and that's all.
He works on a container ship with a consistent route.
Philadelphia, then New York, then Norfolk, Charleston, Jacksonville, a lot of Brazil, Argentina, and then we come back to United States.
Even though they're in port every couple days, this is Nico's first time off the ship in a month and a half.
This time we have a lot of containers for loading and discharging. That's why we are staying for a longer period of time and I have a chance to go on shore. Perfect. Perfect situation, yeah.
His watch is about to start, so he's got to head back to the ship. He and his shipmates grab their stuff and hop in the van. They drive back to the port, past the container maze.
What's in the container?
Oh, who knows? I don't know. We are not opening these containers. We are just transporters.
Open!
Hey, thank you.
Thank you. See you.
Okay, thank you, Mom.
Seafarers are like the truck drivers of the sea. One critical link in a long chain to move goods to get us what we need. And when they get off the ship, they make their own contribution to the global economy.
That's right. Pretty much everywhere in the world, sailors get paid in U.S. dollars. That makes it easy to spend their money in the U.S. Mervin Espiritu just got off a ship, and he got a lift here to the casa. The first thing he buys? M&M's, to replenish the chocolate stash in his cabin.
Okay, Mom, thank you.
$3.30. He sits down on a bench with three other guys. They're waiting for a taxi into town. The ship just got in this morning. They came here from Turkey.
Very far, 24 days on sea.
The ship doesn't usually go to the U.S. When Mervin found out they were coming here, he was excited. Mervin's the youngest in the group. He's only 21, and it's his first time in the U.S.
First time in the land of America.
Ask him what he was thinking when he found out they were coming to America.
Best Buy. It's the first thing. Best Buy.
Best Buy?
Really?
No.
Apparently, yes. And he's ready to accomplish his mission. On board, you're either in uniform or your PJs. So when you finally get a chance to go out, you get dressed up. Mervin's looking sharp in his spotless Nikes, blue jeans, aviator sunglasses, and a big empty backpack ready to fill with his purchases. The taxi driver shows up and we pile in.
Which one is Best Buy? There are so many Best Buy.
Near.
Okay.
All right. We exit the port security gate and we're driving along down the main drag, passing strip malls, parking lots, fast food joints.
Starbucks again?
Welcome to the USA.
That's three Starbucks before we finally arrive. There it is, Best Buy. Mervin pays for the taxi. $21, second purchase of the day. And now, the moment he's been waiting for.
Special laptop.
Laptop? I will buy laptop.
I don't know how Best Buy has gotten to be world famous among seafarers, but every time I hang out with sailors in the U.S., we always end up at a Best Buy. New York City, Savannah, Miami. So, here we go again. Mervin winds his way through the laptop section, comparing features. How many gigabytes? What's the processor speed?
Well, do you have another color of this?
I can check one more time and see. Make sure. Let me see it. Is this one, right?
Yes.
What color was you looking for?
We've been here for almost an hour. Mervin circled through the maze of laptops at least six times now.
Too many choices here.
At one point, he comes to a stop, puts his hands on his hips, his eyes glazed over. That department store drug buzz. Finally, he makes a decision.
It's the only color, and we only have one left.
At the cash register, Mervin opens his wallet. Oh. He takes out six crisp, brand new $100 bills. Dang.
Cash advance?
This was last week's cash advance. A portion of his paycheck he requested early. The rest is sent back home every month to the Philippines. Oh yeah, plus tax. He takes out $50 more. Third purchase of the day. $634.70. That's more than a month's paycheck for Mervin. He's just starting out, so he makes $400 a month. That's already four times what he made back home at his old job at a factory in the Philippines. Once he's promoted to third engineer, he'll make a few thousand a month. That's good money. Money's what draws people to the sea. Sure, some like the sound of adventure, but let's be real. They know the job's tough. They make the choice to have a better life. It's a trade-off.
I have my new laptop now.
Mervin's going to use his new laptop to study for his engineer's license when he gets back home. But in the meantime, he'll have his own onboard entertainment. He's going to copy lots of movies from his shipmates.
Okay.
We finally emerged from the beeping fluorescent gadget maze. What's next?
We've got to McDonald's.
McDonald's. Yep. Getting the real American experience. We set off walking down the side of the freeway, scouting the horizon for the golden arches.
I don't know if it's okay to cross the street here. Sir!
We dash across the highway into the McDonald's.
Big Mac. Meal.
Large?
Three. Yes, three.
Mervin orders three Big Macs. One for him, and one to bring back to Captain and Chief Engineer.
How much is that?
$23.46. Purchase number four. That brings his grand total up to $681.18. Of the four of them, Mervin's the biggest spender.
Can you believe you spent all that money?
If it is converted to Philippine money, it's big.
Better not convert it, huh?
Yeah, better not convert.
Back in Philippines, maritime schools have a slogan. Come, sail, see the world for free. So far, Mervin's seen Turkey, Spain.
The last time I ate McDonald's was in Romania.
In Romania?
And now, USA. By the way, that computer he bought, it was made in China. Came here on a ship.
Oh.
One purchase, definitely made in the USA. This Big Mac.
Do you think it's really a Big Mac?
It's really a Big Mac?
Yes, it's not big. It's not big.
Not big enough?
Not big enough.
Only all-American product, but it's a disappointment.
Small Mac.
Small Mac.
I miss this.
Up next, what's it like to be in a relationship with somebody who spends most of their time at sea? Find out when State of the Reunion returns. Support for State of the Reunion comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a growing network of listeners, producers, and stations collaborating to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
From 12-foot elk antlers to crustacean claws that move faster than a speeding bullet, I'm John Dankosky. Join me on Science Friday when we unlock the arsenal of extreme animal weapons. Plus, science takes a cue from indie culture. We'll look at why some scientists are turning to crowdfunding. That's on Science Friday from PRI.
Friday afternoon at 1 on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL and by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, committed to helping clients achieve their retirement income goals since 1990. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
Today on State of the Reunion, we're digging into the lives of merchant seamen, truckers who sail the seven seas to bring us the goods we need. So we've heard about what it's like to be stuck on a ship, and what happens when the ship finally hits port in the U.S., but what's it like to be on the other end, to be a spouse waiting at home? Producer Allison Swaim tracked down some sailors' wives to find out.
I'm Elizabeth Stiles, and I'm the wife of Wilbur B. Stiles.
My name is Millie Raditich.
I'm Tia Petrovich, and I'm the wife of Anthony Petrovich.
Today is the monthly meeting for the Association of Merchant Mariner Veterans here in Newark, New Jersey.
All right, guys, let's get settled down. Let's get the coffee. Get comfortable. This is going to be a long meeting.
Oh, yeah?
While the guys meet downstairs, Tia, Millie, and Liz sit around a table and prep cold cuts for lunch.
How about if I have turkey and then look at this?
And the salami.
We never bought salami in a long time.
Tia's husband Tony was at sea for the first 40 years of their marriage.
So we were married 20 years. As a friend of mine said, that's why your marriage lasted so long.
Tony started sailing when he was 17. They met a few years later.
Well, we met in New Jersey at a dance.
At a dance?
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
I guess he must have been home.
Yeah, he was home.
And then you had to see him off right after you got married?
A couple of months after, oh, yes.
That's hard.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of relationship. For one thing, you get used to saying goodbye a lot.
was always a letdown, you know, mm-hmm. when he left. Yeah. Yeah. You always have to get adjusted again of being alone.
Being alone, that's right.
Yeah.
Being married to a sailor changes you.
I was always independent. I still
yes,
am.
You have
but,
to.
But you become much more independent.
You have to make the decision without yeah. asking.
Yes, without asking. Right.
It's hard spending so much time apart.
Especially for the children, they yeah. don't see their father, you know, doesn't come home at every night like the other fathers come home. And you have to keep reminding the children, you know, daddy's here, daddy's there.
You're on your own, especially when it comes to raising the children.
I was the bad one because you were the one that was disciplining. And one thing where I made a decision, but I made my son write to my husband. He wanted to ride in the trunk of the car. And I said, that's not allowed. You can't do that. And he's nagging and whining. And I said, you know what? Write a letter to Daddy. Ask him if you can ride in the trunk of the car. If he says yes, then it's okay. And my husband writes, are you crazy? What are you doing? But I had to. That was the only way I could get him off my back.
I took care of that.
Yes.
So, Allison, it sounds like it really changes you to be in this sort of relationship. Takes a strong character.
Yeah. You know, there's this image of a wife sitting at home, the girl waiting on the shore for a ship to come in, for her man to return. But in reality, it's kind of the opposite. You're not sitting around.
I had to take care of everything, bringing up children, household duties. It's all my responsibility.
That's Tatiana Shulgina.
Shulgina, Tatiana Vinyaminovna.
Tatiana's the main character in our next story, a story of a sailor's wife who refused to wait patiently. She spoke to us through a translator from her home in Rostov, Russia, where she lives with her husband, Alexander. Alexander worked as a captain for 40 years, so she got used to long stretches alone.
There is nothing worse in life than to wait and to try to catch up.
6 months, 9 months even, he'd be away. It became normal, part of life. But one particular time, he'd been gone for 6 months when Tatiana had a strange, unsettling dream.
I dreamt that he was sitting there and wanted to talk to me and turned his face to me, and there wasn't any face.
She started to suspect that something wasn't right. She contacted the shipping company and found out that the ship was in port in Nigeria, and they'd already been there for 5 months.
They kept telling me that everything is cool, take it easy. The ship is just staying there. It happens that the ship spends a long time in port.
But Tatiana knew something was up. So she took a train from her home in Russia to the company headquarters in Mariupol, Ukraine. That's when she discovered the truth. Her husband's ship was being held hostage by a Nigerian warlord. She couldn't get much information. The company itself was sort of sketchy.
They wanted to handle everything quietly. They didn't want to raise a stink.
They wanted her to be quiet, too.
Stop running around, Tanya. Just go home and wait quietly. So I went home.
Tatiana went home, but she did not keep quiet. She started writing letters. Lots and lots of letters.
I wrote to more than 20 organizations. I wrote to newspapers, local TV stations.
Tatiana's letter traveled from one office to the next. Nobody knew what to do with it.
So they wrote the Secretary General of the United Nations. So it gets to the Secretary General's office, and so, oh, this looks like something with the ocean. So they sent it down to the UN Law of the Sea office. So they said, oh, let's call Doug. So they, you know, they sent it to me. Yeah, my name is Douglas Stevenson. I direct the Seamen's Church Institute's Center for Seafarers' Rights. We are a legal aid society for merchant seafarers.
Doug's office assists seafarers with all sorts of issues. Unpaid wages, visa problems, mental health. Still, it's not often they get requests like this.
The letter was talking about our husbands are being held hostage in Nigeria. Their health is deteriorating. We got to get them out. What can you do? You know, help us get them out.
Doug decided he'd do what he could to help.
I traveled to Ukraine, met the wives, and I tell you, these wives, they were forced to reckon with. I mean,
I'm a stubborn person, very determined. I will not give in to anybody.
I was more afraid of them than a lot of other things, so they really motivated me to try to get something going for these guys.
Doug got to the bottom of the case. Here's what happened. The ship, the motor vessel Dubai Valor, was carrying oil drilling equipment from India to Nigeria. They were rounding the Cape of Good Hope when they hit a bad storm. Some of the cargo slid off the deck into the ocean and was lost. When they got to Nigeria, they traveled a day and a half upriver to a small village in the middle of the jungle to deliver the cargo, and that's where the trouble began.
The owner of the cargo, a guy named Chief Idisi, put in a cargo claim.
A cargo claim. He was basically suing for the lost cargo.
And so they did a survey, and the insurance company, everybody, the surveyor, said that the claim is worth $200,000. Well, Chief Idisi said it's worth $17 million. So it went through the Nigerian courts, and Chief Idisi defied all the court orders. He basically held the ship and four of its officers, the captain, chief mate, chief engineer, and the radio officer, basically held them hostage on that ship as a bargaining chip for his cargo claim.
Chief Idisi moved the ship into the middle of the river and installed guard towers at both ends, 8 guards per tower, on watch 24/7.
They weren't allowed to go off the ship, and I mean, these guys were being really, you know, psychologically abused.
They counted them every day, and the guards threatened them.
By the time Doug got involved, Tatiana's husband and the three of his shipmates had been held on board for a year and a half. Doug called all his international connections and went to work.
Oh, we did everything. We were writing letters. I wrote a letter to the Commonwealth Ministerial Action Group for things. We filed cases with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. And
Chief Idisi was not going to back down easily, though.
I mean, for example, at one stage, the Supreme Court of Nigeria ordered the release of this crew. And the Russian government, from the Russian embassy, they went with the lawyers and the court order and some policemen to deliver the order to Chief Idisi. And they got beaten up and sent back.
Chief Idisi was playing some serious hardball, so Doug decided to do the same.
Chief Idisi used to live in Texas. I found out he had a Texas driver's license.
And he had a visa that would allow him to do business in the U.S.
So I got this, tried to get the State Department to revoke his visa. If you're dealing with foreign business people and you get their visas revoked, that has an impact.
But the State Department didn't revoke the visa. During all of this, you'd think that Tatiana would lose hope.
No, never. I never gave up hope. Not for a minute.
She kept fighting. She even tried to go to Nigeria herself.
I already had tickets to go to Lagos to see the president. Doug stopped me. He said, no, don't go to Lagos. No way. You'll be lost there. We won't be able to find you again.
After trying everything, Doug enlisted the help of an international law firm.
And our idea was, okay, we're going to file a case in the International Court of Justice in The Hague. We're under no illusions that we had a winning case. All we wanted to do was get them to accept the case, which would cause enough embarrassment to Nigeria, because Nigeria was also complicit in this. I mean, it wasn't just Chief Idisi acting on his own.
So Doug met with the Nigerian High Commissioner in London.
And I said, yeah, we're going to file this case. I just thought I'd give you an advance copy of the complaint so you wouldn't be blindsided by it.
It might have been their case. It might have just been coincidence. Whatever it was, just a few days later, the crew of the Dubai Valor was finally released after 2 years of being held hostage. As soon as the ship got out of Nigerian waters and into the open ocean, the captain sent a fax to Doug.
Okay, this is a fax sent by the ship on May 11th, 1999. Dear Mr. Douglas Stevenson, please be informed that 4 Ukrainian seafarers, which had been 24 months without a break and shore aboard the MV Dubai Valor, are free and now all right. All caps.
Tatiana's husband was finally on his way home. A few weeks later, she went to the airport and met him.
I was wearing a suit and the beautiful shoes.
He didn't seem to notice what she was wearing. He was just tired. Tatiana credits the release to Doug.
I cannot even express how grateful I am.
On the other hand, if she hadn't written all those letters, the ship might still be sitting there. As crazy as that story sounds, the crazier thing is that it's not all that uncommon. Doug says since 2006, over 5,000 seafarers have been held hostage by pirates.
What happens to these people? And for the most part, we don't know. They disappear in the woodwork. I know about these 4 guys. We know about the Maersk Alabama crew. We know about some of the crews, but
for the most part, ships and sailors are off the radar. We don't really hear a lot about them on the news.
We Americans don't appreciate how important shipping is to our everyday life. The next time you go to the mall, check the origin of the anything you see. All the things in that mall come here on a ship in one of these containers. If shipping were to stop, half the world would starve to death and the other half would freeze to death.
Even though we depend on ships to maintain life as we know it, they're basically invisible to most of us in the U.S.
We don't see it. We used to see it, you know, turn of the century. Everybody in New York knew about shipping because you saw this forest of sailing ships' masts surrounding the island of Manhattan.
The ships were seen everywhere. There'd be 100, 200 ships in New York Harbor lined at the piers. Now there's nothing.
A few decades ago, crews were bigger and there were a lot of American sailors. Gabe Frank was one of them.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was working in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But then there were more ships. There were more seamen. I was born in New York City. My mother died. I was 6 years old. My brother was five. We went to an orphan home for 4 years, 7 foster homes. And in World War II, I was 16, and the city told me I'd help myself. They couldn't support me anymore. On the radio, I heard young men join the Merchant Marine, United States Maritime Service. So I joined up. I was a merchant mariner for 23 years. It takes a certain type of person, a person brought up in comfort and luxury. They don't adapt to the sea, no. But for somebody who had a rough way to go, you could take it. When you go to sea, you're alone out there, 10, 20, 30, 40 days at sea. It's a lonely life. You ever hear puppy love? You ever hear of that? I shipped out, then I come back. I went upstate, that's where I met my future wife. I married her, went to Niagara Falls for the honeymoon, but then I had to ship out again. I'd have a penny in the bank. I came back from the Persian Gulf, Kuwait. She told me she wants to be free. She wants to, like, go to movies, dance. She wants to be tied down. I was heartbroken. I almost fell to pieces. If I'd have hanged around here, I would have been But what happened, I got a ship, Japan, Korea, Philippines. I came back to New York 11 months later. That 11 months cured me. It got me back. Just being out on the ocean air, you call it anodyne, a panacea, a cure. Ninety-five countries, 220 seaports, 4 times around the world. I've been in 40 ports in Africa, up the Congo River, all over India, Pakistan, Japan, Korea, Philippines, China, Siberia, Italy, Sicily, Bulgaria, Romania. And the ship went there, so I went there. How does it change you on a ship? It broadens your outlook. You see the world, how people live, how people feel. You see rich people, poor people, hungry people, people of wealth. You see everything.
So, Allison, you spent a lot of time on ships, met a lot of sailors. What about you? I mean, what'd you come away with?
You know, Al, I have this sense, strange, unsettling feeling. These ships are slowly, steadily rearranging the world, piece by piece. They say once the water gets in the blood, you can't get it out. Water gotta stay. I'll only be out here for 5 years. Make a little money, go back home, but 10, 20, 30 years later, they're still out here.
But what's the cost of that? I mean, if you're always, you know, out to sail, like, what happens to the life that normal people have? Like, it's just passing you by, right?
Yeah. For example, this guy that I met, he's a chief engineer, his name's Doru. We sailed together on the Indian Ocean.
But the explanation that I have, that the sea, it's a drug. I mean, a mean one, like the cocaine or something. It's giving you something, but at the end, the price is high. You have to wait. You say to yourself, okay, one more day have passed, it's passed away, and you're happy. But it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy because its life is passing.
I mean, people go to sea to make a better life for their families, but...
But your family grows up without you.
It's a trade-off. Trading time for money. It's kind of like you're trading one world for the other. You can't really have both. When you go home, you're just kind of on vacation. You know what, though? My friend Mihai from Romania, he says working at sea has made him a better person.
What you can do on the ship? You start thinking, you know? Maybe you have plenty of time here to think about things, you know? About people, about world, and everything.
He spends so much time away from his family that when he is home, he makes the most of every moment.
Truckers of the High Seas was produced by Allison Swain, with help from interns Jake Harper and Tracy Mumford, and our senior editor, Taki Teledonitis. The rest of the So True staff is business manager Bree Burge and producers Tina Antolini and Delaney Hall. Special thanks to the Big Shed family, Danny Reznor, Jonathan Thayer, Charles Maines, Deb George, Julia Harris, and all of the Trade Route artists. For photos, videos, and more stories from this episode and others, you can go to our website, stateoftheunion.com. So True is distributed by PRX and NPR, with major funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Dolores Barr Weaver Fund at the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida. I'm Al Letson, and remember, things fall apart. It's our job, all of us, to bring them back together.